usual caveat on a human being, on a mistake. The title of this session is Words of Comfort, Caring for Family Members and Friends Who Are Getting On in Years and Not Functioning as Well as They Used To, a biblical approach. It was actually Rose who asked me to do this, not so much asked, but insisted upon me doing this. It's not a comfortable subject. The responsibilities we have to face up to in dealing with it are not comfortable responsibilities. So this morning isn't going to be light and entertaining and comforting. Just want you to know that, but it could be good. It could be very good. First question I always ask on any topic, what does Jesus say? I want to set this session on a strong foundation of something that Jesus said. In fact, I think Jesus said a few things, said this thing, and I could almost, you know, say, okay, Jesus said this, you will love your neighbour as yourself. He put it another way. He said, in everything do to others as you would have them do to you, for this is the law and the prophets. This thing about loving our neighbours isn't an option. It's absolutely fundamental to being a Christian. And whether it's a member of our family who's getting old or anyone else, it's absolutely fundamental to the way we live our lives. So I could actually sit down at that point because I've said everything that needs to be said, possibly. This is how we treat people who are suffering from dementia. This is people who are suffering from how we treat people from Alzheimer's. We love them. It's that simple. We treat them the way we'd like to be treated ourselves if we were in that situation. We treat them with respect. We treat them with affection. That's what we do. It's a recurrent theme throughout the Old and New Testaments that God wants us to look after particular people. The poor, the alienated, the disadvantaged. So anyone who comes into that group, right through the Old Testament, right through the New Testament, we know that it is our job. If we call ourselves Christians, if we call ourselves by Jesus' name, if we take on his name and his reputation, then we have a clear responsibility to look after people who are disadvantaged, who are alienated, who are strangers. And God tells us to love our neighbour, and he makes absolutely no exceptions. This was clear in the story of the Good Samaritan, which I assume you're all familiar with. Our job is to love our neighbour, and an important thing in that is that love is not an action, love is not an activity, love is an attitude of our hearts. It's how we feel about other people is love. It's not something we do. Well, we're coming back to that a couple of times. When God looks at us, he looks at our hearts, he doesn't look at what we do. The Lord does not look at the things that people look at. People look at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. Here's another one from Jeremiah. I, the Lord, search the heart and examine the mind to reward each person according to their conduct, according to what their deeds deserve. Don't misread this. It's easy to look at that and just concentrate on the last bit. When God looks at what we do, he looks at our hearts and our minds. So he's mostly interested in why we do it. He's interested in motive. And that's a very important point. The good works that we do must be the result of our love, must be the result of what's in our hearts. It must be a symptom of our love. There's another thing about our love for each other, is that it should be obvious. It will be obvious if it's genuine. It's going to be obvious. Jesus said, by this everyone will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another. We're supposed to be a different kind of community. We're supposed to be a community that other people will look at and say, these people really care about each other and they care about others. They must be followers of Jesus. 2,000 years, I don't think we're doing too well. Personally, I don't think we're doing too well. But there are groups, there are individuals who you can look at through the history of the church and say, yeah, they got it right. And to a great degree, I believe that this church is one of those groups. Talking specifically about, I should have said probably at the beginning, but I'm not an expert on Alzheimer's or dementia or anything like this. I've been asked to take a biblical approach this morning. That's what I'm doing. It might be good sometime to get somebody who is an expert. I know there's a lot of people in the church who have relatives or friends who are who are suffering either from dementia or Alzheimer's. In fact, that's why Rose suggested that we have this session. Altered relationships. Well, what's the practical implications of what I've just been saying about a Christian's duty to love? For those who are relatives or friends who are getting old, who are losing their faculty. When someone we know or love gets into that state, it alters their relationships. It alters their relationships with their members of the family, with other people who they know. For decades, for a very long time, they may have a particular kind of relationship with people who are close to them, and suddenly this is changing. It's not what it was before. I've got a suspicion that we all actually know what this feels like. And I want to concentrate for a minute on what it actually feels like for them. And I suspect we all know what this is like. We've all probably, those of us who've been in the workforce, have probably been in situations in the workforce where suddenly relationships have changed. I was in the workforce for, the regular workforce, for 40-something years. And quite regularly, there was a repetitive thing there. A new boss would turn up and they'd think I was vulnerable. They think, what a smart guy. They think, you know, this guy really, you know, knows what's going on. And then a little while later, things would change. For some reason or other, I'm not really quite sure what it was, but for some reason or other, the boss would start thinking that maybe I wasn't as great as they thought they was, and sometimes things got downright hostile. Relationships with the boss changed, obviously, but relationships with other people in the workforce changed as well. You know, my colleagues, things would change. And I also wanted to give a particular personal account, which many of you, excuse me, if my nose is running when I'm preaching, it's usually really good. It's a good sign. I don't know why it is. I know one other person who suffers from the same whatever it is. Most of you would have been around 4 years ago when I was told that I had cancer. Do you remember that? Yes. It was serious. Basically, I was told that I had to have an operation. If I didn't have the operation, or if I did have the operation and they didn't get all of the cancer at one go, I was going to die. It was that simple. Here I am 4 years later standing in front of you. They got all the cancer, apparently. That's one reason I'm mentioning that is that when other people found out what was going on, relationships changed. They all were altered. Not permanently, but quite seriously. It was really noticeable that, you know, I put the word out and the word got round, and the word actually got round the world very quickly what was going on. And if I met someone who I hadn't seen since the news got out, there was this difficulty. The relationship was completely different to what it had been before. And you know, there was a distancing in some cases. There were people just, you know, trying to find the right thing to say. And I want to give you an example of someone who said exactly the right thing. And that's Luke, who I'm delighted to see this morning. He has not had my permission to tell this story. I'll just make it absolutely clear. Luke was away at the time. When I found out I had cancer and when we first talked about it here in the church, Luke was away and he obviously wasn't checking his emails. Because the next time I saw him was just outside there at the front of the church. He'd been away for a while, and he came bouncing across the grass towards me, and he said, "Hello, Peter, how are you?" And I responded to that. So I succinctly and concisely as I could, I told him what was going on, and he stood there, like that, staring at me, as I told him what was going on. And then when I finished, he took his hand away from his mouth, and he said, "I don't know what to say." And it was the best thing he could have said. He wasn't coming up with the right words. He was just saying, "I haven't got any." And in saying that from his heart, he was telling me,
oh dear.
He was telling me everything I needed to know. That's something that happened really suddenly. In that case, the relationships altered really suddenly. And of course, they've gone back to what they were before since then. For someone with dementia, things don't get better. And they happen very, very slowly. So those relationships alter very slowly. The person who is suffering from dementia knows that they are altering, certainly in the early stages, probably later on. They are aware that this is happening and they feel that sense of distancing. You understand me? They feel that things have changed and they may not be sure why. Excuse me. During my preparation for this session, I came across this book. It's called Dementia, Living in the Memories of God, by a guy called John Swinton, who is a professor of pastoral care at the University of Aberdeen. One thing that really, I'm not good at reading books, so I skimmed through this one, and suddenly I found him talking about the sheep and the goats. And I thought, oh, that's interesting, because the sheep and the goats is a keeps coming up in this church, you know? Seems to pop up fairly regularly. Are you familiar with the story of the sheep and the goats? So Jesus saying, on the last day I'm going to divide people up, and there will be these people that I will say to them, because you looked after me, because you took care of me, because you gave me something to drink, because you gave me something to eat, you're in, guys. And they're going to say, but we don't know you. And he's going to say, if you did this for any member of my family, and I think when he says my family, he means everybody, humanity, you did it for me. One of the things he says in that is, when I was a stranger, you welcomed me. And Mr. Swinton, who wrote this book, says basically that I was a stranger and you welcomed me. He says, this is a complete change of status. He said, in the same way that if somebody's hungry and you give them food to eat, they're no longer hungry. If they're a stranger and you welcome them, they are no longer a stranger. But this isn't a temporary thing. This is a permanent thing. To welcome a stranger, you're welcoming them, you're making them part of your own community, part of your own family. And this is what we are called to do. But just as importantly, we have to make sure that those people who are part of our family don't become strangers. Do you understand what I'm saying? We need to welcome people in and make sure that they stay welcome, make sure they stay part of our community. In this particular instance, that can be quite difficult. Am I getting that point across? We have to make sure that as people get older, they don't become strangers, that they stay part of the community, and that they know, to the best of their ability, that they are a part of the community. It's very easy to sideline somebody who's got this kind of a condition. One of the problems is that they're no longer the person they were. And the temptation to just turn away from them is very strong. There's another issue here, which is that Western culture, our culture, puts a very high premium on a person's ability to think, a person's ability to express themselves well. But we put a very high premium on the mental processes, if you understand me. I think you've probably all heard of this phrase, I think, therefore I am, Descartes. Well, there's another academic whose name is Stephen Post, who made the point, I think, therefore I am. If we put such a big emphasis on a person's ability to think, then what happens when they don't show that they can think? When they cease to be able to demonstrate that they can think, does that mean that at that point they are not? That they cease to be humans to us at that point? We are made to live in community. We are intended for community. God made us to live in community. If we're not part of the community, if we don't feel that we're part of the community, we won't be healthy. The importance of being in a community, that is, a place where we are accepted and loved, cannot be overestimated. Is the converse true? Are you all with me, by the way? Anybody want to say anything at this point? Is this too heavy? No? Okay, we'll go on. This actually is heavy, just warning you. If a person isn't part of a community, or doesn't feel that they are part of a community, are they more likely to suffer from dementia or Alzheimer's disease? The simple answer seems to be yes. There was a study done 2007. Whenever I read something that says a study has shown that, I immediately start thinking, oh yeah, you know, give me more information. You just have to be like that. This study was apparently a reputable study, followed a large number of subjects over a significant period of time, and it was published in the Archives of General Psychiatry, which is now the Journal of the American Medical Association, CRIS. Is the Journal of the American Medical Association a reputable a bit to deal with psychiatry? No?
I prefer it to be something specifically psychiatry.
Yeah, it is. The archives of general psychiatry apparently has now been absorbed into the Journal of the American Medical Association, and it's called JAMA Event Psychiatry. So,
yeah.
You'll give that your tick of approval. Okay, good, excellent. Right. This is the bad news. This study, carried out over a long time, a period of time, with a large number of people who have been studied, found that people who perceive themselves as being lonely were twice as likely to suffer from Alzheimer's disease as those who did. People who perceive themselves as being lonely were twice as likely to suffer from Alzheimer's disease as those who didn't. Well, that's incredible.
Is that referred to they were twice as likely to, at some time in the future, be diagnosed?
Over the period of time of the study, yes. Yes, they were.
So it wasn't that the loneliness was caused by the fact that they were isolated through Alzheimer's?
No, no. But the two worked in a vicious circle. No question about it. Yeah.
What was the period of the study?
I don't know. I couldn't go into too much detail on it. I just wanted to check with the researcher. If you see what I mean. So the way we actually treat people who are suffering from dementia or Alzheimer's may actually affect the condition. It may make it worse, it may make it better. But it may make it worse if we sideline them. How are we doing? We're doing okay, almost. Just give us some practical stuff. We're providing words of comfort. The fact that the words come from the heart, as we've seen, is essential. Just because we can't understand, there's no feedback, just because we're not sure whether the person is actually understanding what we're saying, I think, from what I've read, shouldn't make any difference. We should still treat them the same. We should still treat them with love, respect and affection. Because we simply do not know how much they're picking up. And they may be picking up a lot. So it's very important that we continue to treat them with love and affection and treat them with respect. No matter what kind of a response we're getting from. Words of discomfort. This is just something we picked up in the reading. We need to be very careful how we talk about someone anyway, but we need to be very careful talking about them when they are actually present, because again, we don't know how much they're picking up. So if you are out with someone who's suffering from one of these conditions and you meet someone else, it really is not a good idea to say something like, he won't understand what you're saying. For a kickoff, we don't know that it's true. Or saying, he won't remember. Or he can't remember. And describing someone in those terms as somebody who can't remember, can't do stuff, is obviously damaging to them if they understand what you're saying, and they may well do so, although they may not remember. Getting there. Last week's video we watched Hemant Orinur. There's a second half of that video which we might watch at another time, which included the interviewer. You may have noticed I really didn't like that interviewer. But never mind. I'm singing, but I didn't.
I thought you just didn't like his jumper.
I really didn't like his jumper. But, you've got to say something about the man that he chooses to jump on.
I thought it said the cross-cultural thing was good.
I think it highlighted some of the things that Henri Nguyen was actually saying. So, one of the questions he asked Henri Nguyen later on in the interview, not quite what we saw after, was in the context, he said, of another epidemic which we're facing, which is talking about youth suicide. He said, how do we find words? He said, how do we speak the message of Christ? Nguyen's immediate response was, maybe we shouldn't speak that much. And I think that's That's really important. Sometimes words are just words. There are other ways of communicating. We all know, I think, that words sometimes are different words. It's the words that come from the heart, the kind of words that Luke spoke to me that day, that are needed. As I said, we don't know whether they're understood. It doesn't make any difference to hear them anyway. One thing that probably is understood is touch. One thing that probably is understood is touch. I came across in another context a case of a young boy. This really struck me in this context. Story of a young boy who was born. Not a story. A young boy who was born blind and deaf and suffering from a severe intellectual disability. So in terms of his ability to communicate, there wasn't any. But the people who were working with him noticed there was a difference in the way he responded to different people. And they responded to different touches. They came to the conclusion that he responded warmly to people who were cared about him. He recognised the touch of people who cared about him and people who didn't care about him. And try and look this way, it helps me. Please? He knew the ones who cared about him, and he would actually hold on to them. Whereas people who he felt didn't care about him, he would push them away. Even though he couldn't see and he couldn't hear, and he had limited intellectual capacity, they said there was a very striking, I can see a social worker nodding, there was a very striking difference in the way he responded to people. So at that very basic level, someone could tell the difference between someone who cared about them and someone who didn't. And I think that almost certainly has to be true of people who are in this other stage of dementia or Alzheimer's. If they can't feel anything else, they may well be able to feel touch and to understand touch. Finally, just a few words to comfort the carers. When God looks at us, he looks at our hearts, we already know that. He sees us as we are, as we truly are, as we were and as we will be. So he doesn't see us as we are at the end of our lives with our faculties all gone. He sees us in a complete, whole, true, multi-dimensional way which we can't really understand. He knows exactly what we are like. Omri Owen, in last week's video, used a phrase, I don't know if you remember this, he was saying that God knew us before we were conceived, and he will know us after we die. And he said this, I go from God's intimate embrace to God's intimate embrace. He had a sense that before I was conceived, I was in God's intimate embrace. And when after I die, I will be in God's intimate embrace. And the time in between, when we're alive, is the time when we're not so aware of it. Is the way I would put it. It's only for this brief time on earth that we sometimes do not feel the wind of in God's embrace. But these people we're talking about, the ones who... Irene?
We may not feel it, but it's still there.
Sorry?
We may not feel it, but it's still there.
Absolutely. It is. Totally correct. Well done. Well said. Couldn't agree more. You're right. No, you could be right. You are right. Yes, yes, yeah. I mean, I just said, even if we don't feel it, we are still in God's not going to get into a discussion on universalism here. I'm a devout don't knowist, as I often say. Don't know how God makes his decisions, but I do know that he is a just and loving God and that he makes just and loving decisions, and I'm happy with that. I'm going to leave it there. Does anyone else have anything to say?
My father has dementia, and so I'm involved in supporting my mother and my father this time. And Caitlin, our daughter, is an OT who has some specialty in aged care and dementia care. And she explained it to me as, although Dad can't remember why he feels things and can't express it, that It's like his emotional, having a life where his emotional well-being is cared for is like money in the bank. So every good thing that we do, he has this feeling of well-being. He doesn't know why he has that. He can't remember that we took him out for the walk or whatever. But he has a feeling of well-being, and that's really important. So I encourage those things, and as you go forward, that encourages me that when I spend time with Dad and he can't remember that I came to visit him that day, that it is contributing to his feeling of well-being, and it's money in the bank for him. And the other thing that I wanted to say was, it's not all negative. That my dad, when we didn't have a close relationship when he was busy with business and out with his mates and, you know, doing all that thing. But now that he has dementia, all the worries dropped away. If you can't remember things, you can't worry. And what has emerged is a warm human being that was never there when I grew up. And I am so grateful to have had the opportunity to have got to know this side of my father.
Thank you.
Hey, I was just thinking about how you started the sermon about love needing to be sincere and to have be aware of your motivations, and it's the motivations that make the difference. I'm not convinced of that, and that's partly because I'm not sure that anyone can truly divide what their motivations are. Our capacity for perception is just immense, and whilst we might be able to divine some good things, there might also be some negative things. If you go down that path, you could just, completely disappear down a hole of, well, am I really doing that? And at the end of the day, maybe it's just better to focus on that you'll know them by their fruits, and if the things that you do wind up demonstrating positive values, then maybe at the end that's the best thing you can do.
Yeah. No, I agree. I agree. Nonetheless, if something... people can tell the difference between something that comes from the heart and something that doesn't. I'm talking about that boy, but also talking about the way people respond to people who are usually when they're in relations. There is a definite difference between someone who is saying the right thing or doing the right thing and someone who cares. And I think that's what I'm trying to get out. But I do agree. We do it anyway. Absolutely.
The thing that strikes me out of that too is that when you're saying that it's important to while you're talking in front of someone who has the condition, my sense is that the person who gets most violated by that inappropriate action is not them but us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We oppress and violate ourselves when we fail to be heart driven.
Yeah.
And that's just not to, it's just a both end thing. When we look after someone else, we're actually looking after ourselves.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I wonder if I was wondering if we introduce someone, saying this person has dementia, my dad has dementia, whatever. And what exactly are you saying something about ourselves? We might be saying, oh, sorry for me, I don't know.
If I can put it in a personal context, my mother is lost to memory, and one of my siblings is very concerned that she's lost her dignity, but actually, I think he's very concerned that he's lost his sense of dignity in having a mum who was very capable. And actually, the people that know my mum and love her will keep on knowing and loving her to pick, irrespective of her capacity to remember stuff.
Yeah.
My grandma's lived about 100 days, and I echo that expressed by Lyndon, and also with a child that was blind and deaf. They get a sense of familiarity about the people around them. They may not know who they are, they may not remember their lives, but they understand the familiar faces and the love that they give to them and express to them. So when I come to my mum's house and look after grandma's time, she'll see my face and know that that's a familiar, loving person in the way I interact. Buddhism. Whereas if the stranger comes in and says hello, then she'll be quite happy and not know them. So I understand where that's coming. Going back to, I guess, that sort of a primordial instinct of love, and going back, resorting back to those really core aspects of what makes us human beings, I think, and also spiritual for those areas that people are looking after, not just their husbands and wives, which is quite difficult, obviously, but also children as well. My mum is elderly herself, looking after her elderly mum.
Sorry. Luke, I remember being lying there. Sorry.
If I have one piece of advice from my experience working in the spirit for a while, of people who are working or caring for someone in this situation is don't forget to care for yourself. We can't care enough. We need to look after ourselves and share the burden. Because sometimes it is a burden, sometimes it's a point, and sometimes it is hard.
Usually it's both, Luke.
Yeah, at the same time. Yeah.